CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And welcome to the Taylor Report. This is CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
A little mystery guest today. Nobody. Phil and I are going to talk about the important matters. We're going to do what the ordinary person does. We read the sports section first, right?
Well, I do. Yeah.
And as you know, we have... Well, I'll tell you what our outline roughly is. We're going to talk about the NBA. We're going to talk about Raptor Land a little bit. And we're going to talk about we always mix politics and sport because sport always mixes its own politics. So we have to talk about both things. And then we will talk about Venezuela some because they've done something very important. They have a recognition of Afro-Venezuelan culture, and they celebrated the role of Afro-Venezuelans, who make up half the population, in the Bolivarian Revolution. We will also have something to say, I believe, about the Central Park Five, as they were called. That was a dirty label attached to them, five young men went to prison for a long time because the police wanted to have a black prisoner to say that they'd caught the bad guy. The bad guy got away. We'll talk about that. And D-Day. That's a big... Let's talk about... So it's all very quiet at the moment in Raptor Land. The streets are relatively quiet, but there's an air of expectation in the city, wouldn't you say?
We're supposed to win tonight.
Phil, you live a little closer to Ground Zero.
I do. Well, and by the way, I always know how well the game's going, even if I don't have it on, because from the level of noise that I can hear outside. And the night that they beat Milwaukee, yes, I live close, but not that close. I should not have heard it, but I really did, and was loud and long. You know, yeah. A lot of enthusiasm. I mean, it's an amazing amount of enthusiasm.
Yeah. We are very blessed. We have a great leader, Kawhi Leonard, and so we've all taken our instructions today. He says he wants everybody to stay focused, be cool, move the ball, play defense, play the full 42 minutes, or is it 48?
I think it's
okay.
Four,
play the whole
48,
game.
48, yeah, whatever.
And leave it all on the floor. Every sports cliche is very important here, and he is a serene figure you really need such people in the world. And so we're already, you know, mixing politics. And one can learn a lot from the style of Kawhi Leonard, in my opinion. And we, of course, wish him well. In fact, this is not any kind of Cinderella story. This is a very, very good basketball team. They had home court advantage because they won it. They had more wins than the other guys. So this is, sure, you're a challenger until you got the title. But this is a challenger that is not a surprise. This one didn't come out of nowhere. This is a very good team. It has good DNA. It goes way back. I've seen visits now. I'm sure everybody watched Chris Bosh and Vince Carter. A lot of the people who really distinguished the court here. But it's also culturally a very important moment, in my opinion. But we'll probably devote more discussion to that next week when all this will be over one way or the other.
Yes.
But we have to, of course, say, as Ann Garrison did in an article written in the Bayview paper, and I think Black Agenda Report, what you see on the court is the best part. These are the best athletes in this field, going at it, and they really do give it everything. They're inspiring people, and what they do is it costs them their lives to do it. It's like when we talk about great dancers, and Phil, you know, Phil has a program Wednesday 6 to 8 classical underground. The people that you admire most, they live to do what we admire,
and they give up a lot to be able to do it. And once they get there, they gotta keep working at it. You can never coast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, they it's like these. You watch basketball players. Actually, you also Major League Baseball. Yeah. I've been to one of the reasons I enjoy going to the ballpark and watching is I get to just sort of sit and pick out the guy I want to look at. Mm. And they're often doing the simplest motion that we all associate. Oh, he's practicing batting. But you say, good Lord, he's a professional. But he's holding his hands at a certain spot and he's making his body move. It's what they call muscle memory, and they're doing it all the time, and the musicians do it. But basketball players, you see these shots, and of course, who would ever forget the Kawhi shot?
Oh, of course.
And someone pointed out to me, I think it was Ann Garrison, that Dave Zirin, in his column, he writes for The Nation now, he's seen him practice that shot hundreds of times. And I have looked at the biographies of Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, and they practiced awkward shots. That is, you know, running to your left and then leaping at a certain distance. That body has actually been there before. It looks like a miracle that ball goes where it goes. But they've been doing that. So anyway, give them all the credit. So all that leads up to something that's sort of the downside, one might say, of basketball. The people who own the teams are not, you know, Toronto does not own a team. An owner has a team, and he has put it here. And he is not going broke. He's actually doing okay. And there's only one professional team that is owned by a city, and that's Green Bay, Wisconsin. And there's a stipulation in the NFL corporation, and it is a corporate, it's a business, that only Green Bay can do that. Nobody else will be permitted. And they need Green Bay because Green Bay is part of the actual history of the development of the game that is now so popular across the country, and actually starting to catch some interest around the world. They're fishing for more business, more customers. But the other thing is that the owners are actually, very few of them are African Americans. I think none. Maybe the former great Chicago Bull player owns, I think, part of Charlotte.
Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan owns part of Charlotte, I think, Charlottesville. I'm not sure of that.
Yeah.
We occasionally get glimpses of them, like the L.A. Clippers owner whose girlfriend decided to tape him while he talked about black people, and that was not entertaining. He, of course, lost his ability to hold on to that job, actually thanks to such strong individuals as LeBron James and others who have, despite being NBA players, who are pretty much watched very closely. But there are some bigger than the game, like LeBron, who spoke out. He spoke out on Black Lives Matter, and others did as well. And actually, the Golden State guys, a lot of these players, there's a lot of mutual regard, but they also understand what is American culture and the history of struggle of black Americans. And this is a sport in which they really have distinguished themselves, and everybody in the world knows them, knows their images, but the owners are not so well known.
Well, wasn't it one of the part owners of the Warriors who thought he could shove Kyle Lowry the other day?
That happened
just
right in front of me.
Right,
you know, I wasn't sitting behind him, but I was watching. I couldn't believe that had happened. Yeah. I thought, you're not that dumb, but yes,
he is. Yeah, he is.
He's that dumb. So, but that brings us to this problem. In April 11 this year, the NBA had a special dinner, April 11th, just this year, and the guest of honor was Paul Kagame. And the NBA, that was not a player decision. This is a decision of all these white billionaires who own the teams. They have a slogan, and it bothers me too. It's called Basketball Without Borders. You don't need to invent that. Basketball, no kid asked you for permission to, he plays, he, she, if they want to play. But they want to help Paul Kagame, the dictator of Rwanda. And when I say dictator, I ain't kidding. I mean, that guy runs the place with an iron fist. And he's high up on the list of people who is responsible for the bloody events of 1994 called the Rwanda genocide. And which, by the way, he insists you must call the Tutsi genocide. So if you go to a mass grave in Rwanda, it says Tutsi genocide. However, all the evidence shows that the proportions were, if not equal, in other words, Rwandans lost their lives in both ethnic groups. There are two basic ones, Hutu, Tutsi, and then there is the Twa. All of them lost their lives massively because a peace agreement was destroyed by the murder of the president of Rwanda, Habyarimana, and the prime suspect, really, today is Paul Kagame, the man that the NBA owners all want to be chummy with, and they want to help him. And they say, well, you see, he has a vision. He wants to help. He wants to bring NBA to Africa. There's a lot of leaders in Africa. You know, South Africa is probably the country in terms of, you know, economy and size, and it has a political culture of political opposition, difference of opinion, et cetera. They have a broad base. Why didn't the NBA go to them? The answer is they don't control South Africa. Why didn't they go to Tanzania? Because they don't control it. Why didn't they go to Kenya? These are major countries. You want to get to know Africa. But no, they had a guy who is so tight with the State Department that he just flies in and out, and you know, Harvard gives him a prize. Anybody who has any influence in American wealth is his friend. And so this is just a con. And this doesn't look well for the NBA, in my opinion, that they entertain him. They give him nice names. One of the guys that in the upper echelon of management at the Raptors calls him a visionary. Where would he get such a term? Does he mean visionary in the sense that he invaded Zaire/Congo twice with the resulting deaths of 6 million people? That is the estimate of the number of people, and we're not talking about soldiers, civilians, who lost their lives. And, well, he is the State Department's guy. They helped create him, and now they intend to back him up, and so they want the NBA to help him out. The NBA helps out also with the Defense Department. So that's not talked about. You can see it. A lot of people watch NFL games. You can't watch an NFL game without seeing all the, you know, military guys. You have to have a flyover. You have to have a group of veterans on the sidelines. And it's a recruitment exercise. It's, you know, kids, you should join the military. Be like these brave people. Don't be like our great leader, Trump, who had bone spurs between his ears. You have to, you know, you should go over there and die for Uncle Sam. But not like the leaders, like Mr. Pompeo all the rest of that gang. So this is sports helping the empire, I would say. And that is not the good part. The good part is what's going to happen tonight. You know, when you're on the floor, the real guys for whom you really care. But never forget the guys in the background that who play a little role. There's a story I could add to that. There was a famous Bolshevik at the turn of the century. During World War I, he was in Switzerland, I think. And he liked hiking. When he had any time at all, he was a busy guy, but he had any time at all. He liked to go hiking. So one day he challenges a couple friends of his. He says, I think we can reach the top of this mountain here by sundown, if we really work at it. So they accepted the challenge, and they set off, and they made it. The friend was with him who wrote this about this. He said they got to the top of the mountain. The sun was just setting. And he looked and he said, you know, capitalism ruins everything. We're going to take a musical break. We're going to listen to Sam Cooke and a guy named Muhammad Ali, and then we're going to talk about the significance of a heavyweight championship.
Sam Cooke, as you can see, like me, he's awful pretty. And we are here now working on a record called The Gang's All Here. And Sam and I, we expect to have this out in another week or so.
Would you like to give us a preview of this disc?
Well, I want to give you a little introduction. Only this record is talking about, you know, me, the greatest, and the various people in countries such as England and Paris. And we'll give them a sound.
Come on, let's give them a preview.
We'll do a lot better if we had the music here with us.
All right, we're going to do it.
We'll try now.
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one.
Do it again now.
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one.
Is New York with me?
Yeah!
Is Chicago with me?
Yeah!
Is London with me?
Yeah!
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We gonna swing as one.
How you like that?
I like that.
I like that.
He asked if we liked it.
Yeah.
And that was, that really
was the greatest.
Huh?
That was the greatest.
That was the man called the greatest. Yeah. And that's why it brings us to this matter. I don't know, Phil, I think you expressed dismay or you have no knowledge of the latest developments in the world of heavyweight boxing in the world and
No, I have to admit I've lost track years
then
ago.
Then you're my perfect victim.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
No, I'm sure this will it'll interest you.
Yeah.
The Muhammad Ali showed in his life how significant it was and is to be the world champion, and particularly if you have an opinion about things. Muhammad Ali, as you know, you lived through it, he turned his champion status into a political commentary about racism and war and imperialism and such, and he could never leave the stage. He would be, even if he wanted to live quietly, because of the importance of his name, he's probably the most recognized man on the planet at one point. And when Jimmy Carter didn't want the United States to participate in the Russian Moscow Olympics, he called on Muhammad Ali personally to please be his ambassador to Africa, because the African countries said, well, we're going to go to the Moscow Olympics. You have a problem. That's your problem. But we don't. We're going to go. Jimmy Carter's problem, by the way, with the Olympics was that Afghanistan, the Russians were at that time, had been invited by the government of Afghanistan, were there. So Brzezinski and Carter were in a plan to drive them out, and they were using the people that are presently using in Syria, that is so-called jihadis, which manipulated by people with money and guns. So Carter said, because Russia has troops in Afghanistan, we're not going to go to the Moscow Olympics. And he asked Muhammad Ali to do the heavy lifting. Well, Muhammad Ali got as far as, I think, Tanzania, where he met Nyerere, one of the great leaders of Africa. And Nyerere said, you're a nice man. I admire you very much, but you don't know what you're talking about. And Ali came home and said, you know, Sipin, I ought to butt out of this stuff. I don't know. I don't think I better do this. But he was, he showed the importance of having that title of the heavyweight champion, because that's the biggest, toughest guy on the planet in boxing. Well, long story short, boxing has kind of deteriorated because, you know, we have somebody as colorful and smart and talented as Ali. People get a little bored with the next guy. So we've gone through a period of Mike Tyson, we've had Klitschko, there's a little bit of interest. But it's settled into a situation where we have a man named Anthony Joshua, heavyweight. He's a Nigerian British citizen from who is 6'6 and 260 pounds, I believe. These guys are getting big. You know, Joe Louis weighed 200 pounds. Yeah. And Ali, I think, weighed about 211. Later he put on weight. But these guys are really big. And there is a man named Tyson Fury. And Tyson Fury calls himself the Gypsy King. He is actually a Gypsy family. He is 6'9 and about 270, maybe more. And here's a trick about him. He's ambidextrous. And he actually has good footwork. For a man, for 6'9", he can really get around. So he's rough and tough. And then you have Deontay Wilkins, I think his name is. If I get it wrong, everybody shout, thank you very much. Now, Deontay is a man who's got a heavy hitter. Now, these are the three names. They own the place. But one of them, Anthony Joshua, had the belts. He has at least had, excuse me, three belts. And so Deontay said, hey, fight me. Come and fight me. I'm your equal. Everybody knows I have, you know, I'm in there. And then the Gypsy said, pardon that expression, but that's the term he uses for himself, the Gypsy King. He says, it's me. Come and fight me. And they put $100 million on the table. $100 million. Come. Listen, by the way, Phil, I think I'd take on Deontay for $100 million. I'd do it. So anyhow, so Anthony Joshua says, well, when I feel like it, you know, because he has the belts, right? So he's playing Mr. Hard to Get. So he said, people in America don't know me. I'm known in Britain. He can fill Wembley Stadium. He filled it. People to watch him. He took the title away from Klitschko. So he says, I'm going to go to Madison Square Garden so the Americans can get to know me. And he said, I want to fight this guy. So the guy said, I'll fight you. He had a good record and all that. I do not know his name. But he also said, you know, nowadays they take tests. It turned out he had that stuff, what do you call it?
Oh, yeah.
Steroids. So they said, now we're in trouble. We've got 3 weeks to go, and we don't have a guy to fight him. So there's a Mexican fighter. His name was Andy Ruiz Jr., and he says, I got a good record. I'm not afraid of this guy. I'll fight him. And he said, I hear that you don't want a phony fight. You want somebody who mix it up with the champion. By the way, Anthony Joshua, unbeaten, 22-0. So he said, okay. So he fights Ruiz. The new heavyweight champion of the world is Andy Ruiz Jr., Mexican. Here's how he put it at his press conference. He knocked him out. He stopped Anthony Joshua. They said, well, how do you feel? He says, I am the first Mexican heavyweight champion of the world, baby. That's me. Ruiz Jr. Weighs 262 pounds. He's 6'2". There's never been a heavyweight champion from Mexico. Mexican fighters tend to peter out. I shouldn't use that expression, but they around the middleweight division, that's where they are dominant. Through the lighter divisions and up, they tend to be smaller fighters. You would know Filipinos have a similar reputation.
Right. Flyweights, lightweights,
yeah,
things
like that. Rarely you see them in the heavier divisions. So now he's Mexican-American. He's from California. But the press conference after the fight, you have to watch it. This is he now has the attention of the world, and he is sitting in front of a Mexican flag, and he says,
oh, "I love it.
The Mexicans are the heavyweight champions." And you know, in sport, they have this expression. They say, "What is luck in sports?" Because they wish you luck. They say, "Luck is when preparation meets opportunity." And Andy Ruiz Jr., after the fight's over, everybody said, oh, well, a little detail. He has more professional fights than the guy he knocked out. He has 31 professional fights, one defeat, and he smiles and he says, that was a decision. I won that fight. And he said, by the way, he says, I understand I should take him out because you don't trust referees. You know, you go to the guy's hometown, that kind of thing, look out. You better put him out if you want to win the title. So, incident, that's also an old boxing cliche that nobody who's a challenger should be given the title unless he clearly wins. He should dominate, because if it's close, he doesn't deserve it. He's, you know, they're going to prove that you're the champion. So now, George Foreman, you know his name, and Evander Holyfield and Lennox Lewis, who, by the way, he won the super heavyweight champion of the Olympics for Canada. He was a Canadian fighter. In this town, he can't get any respect at all. I've never understood why we don't embrace him. He actually did all those things and became the heavyweight champion. But he talked about this, and he said, you know, he said, I'd seen the guy. He said, he's a very skilled fighter, but he has a body that doesn't – people get – they're looking at his body, and they think, this can't be the champion. You know, Anthony Joshua looks like he belongs on the cover of a, you know, weight – Bodybuilder magazine or Vogue or something, or one of those, what is it, Q magazine?
GQ.
What is it?
GQ.
GQ.
Yeah.
He's cut, as they say, you know. And by the way, when we hear the word cut in boxing, we say steroids. But anyhow, but Andy Ruiz Jr. has a physique like a barrel, and he's covered with tattoos. And he doesn't have a boxing personality. He smiles all the time. Everything he thinks everything's funny. And
well, right now he's right.
he's especially smiling now. And he as Lennox Lewis said, the world thought he didn't look like a champion. Well, but we don't go by looks, particularly in the heavyweight division. You can George Foreman, when he was 44, was knocking people out, and he looked like a barrel, but he was a barrel of experience. And Andy Ruiz has very fast hands, and he is a seasoned fighter. He knows how to react when he's hit. He knows how to avoid punches. There's a skill called slipping. He knows how to slip a punch, and he does it with real style. But he's also in the DNA of what they call Mexican fighters. Mexican fighters are very and proud of the tradition of being guys who mix it up. You know, they say, I'm coming for you. they don't back up. But he showed all this great talent, and the heavyweight division is now knocked into a cocked hat. Foreman was asked, what would you tell Anthony Joshua? He said, don't get back in the ring with that guy. No, he said, don't do it. Because he said, you don't know what happened. He said, until you can figure out what he did to you, you don't try it again. This is, you know, but back to what it means, Mexicans now have a heavyweight champion. And they've changed the discussion. The other thing is, we're going to see a lot more of the flags. And of course, you know, we have a fence that's being built. It's kind of important. Here's the heavyweight champion, happens to be now Mexican. He's on the California side of that, but he likes that Mexican flag. And we're going to see trainers and people that we don't know. Because like with Ali, Joe Lewis, if you talk about these fighters, they're very important. They're always around them, were an entourage of personalities that you got to know. And this is going to happen with Ruiz. We're going to be learning about people that we've never seen. And we're going to be hearing politics. I saw his trainer and his previous manager, or maybe his present, interviewed. And they said, oh, is he Mexican? Really? And he said, listen, we have Jewish Americans, Italian Americans, German Americans, and Mexican Americans. And he says, he is a Mexican who lives in the United States. And I said, oh, that's better. You know, he handled that better than most politicians.
Yes.
Yeah, he is a Mexican. By the way, he got there an easy way. After all, after the uneven contest in the dirty war, the Mexican-American war. Americans ended up with California, Texas, Utah, Colorado. So, and Andy Ruiz's people were there. Somebody drew a line and said, now you're here. You used to be there, but now you're, So it's, I mentioned those names. Joe Louis was associated with the victory in World War II. He was supposed to illustrate that America, unlike Hitler, we were the multi-ethnic state and we had the respect for people. And therefore, Joe Louis was treated as a hero. The greatest name we should all honor in the history of heavyweight boxing is Jack Johnson, who Arthur Ashe, a great tennis player and a great scholar, died much too young. Arthur Ashe was in a debate once with a sports columnist, very famous one, Howard Cosell. And they said, who's the greatest black athlete, most important black athlete in American history? And Howard Cosell said, it's Jackie Robinson, hands down. And Arthur Ashe said, no, Jack Johnson. In other words, you're looking white perspective, black perspective. Jack Johnson settled the issue of equality, courage, talent, brains, all those things. Jack Johnson was the guy. And there were race riots in America because the blow to white supremacist culture was delivered by Jack Johnson. So don't underestimate the significance of the first Mexican heavyweight champion of the world, Andy Ruiz, as the band says, Junior. We're going to take a little musical break. We're going to listen to some Venezuelan music, and we're going to say some things about Venezuela. And we're back. It is the Taylor Report, CIUT. By the way, we're on SoundCloud at the Taylor Report, and we are on Facebook, the Taylor Report. Is there any twist in it? One's got a hyphen.
Yeah.
You'll find it.
Yeah, right. It's easier and easier to find all the time.
Yeah. Come look for us. We're there. And you can write to us. The address is the Taylor Report at gmail.com, I believe. Maybe not. Is it CIUT?
Yeah, you go on to CIUT.fm.
CIUT.fm. The Taylor Report at CIUT.fm. I should go there, shouldn't I? I would check it out. Yeah, do write to us. The reason we played the music is I want to thank President Maduro. He's not very much admired in Ottawa, but I think he's a great guy. He won the presidency. I know that the guy named Guaido, he didn't win nothing. He didn't win nothing, but Chrystia Freeland prefers him and his colleague who is hiding in the Spanish embassy, who says he's Spanish, which is, that brings me to my point. Maduro, as the Hugo Chavez before him, recognizes the importance and significance of racism, the struggle against racism, struggle against slavery in Venezuela. It should be annually noted, and the role of Afro-Venezuelans, who make up probably 50% of the population, although in Guaido's circles you wouldn't know that. And what I, something I particularly want to thank the Venezuelans for noting was the name of José Chirino. This was a name I did not know, and we're supposed to be trying to grow all the time. We're supposed to learn, right? And I was embarrassed that I did not know this name. And Chirino is, he's a figure from who struggled against slavery. I don't know his entire story. He was what's called mixed race himself. He lived. He was on a plantation where there was a large slave population. I think he might have been. He was sort of he had a sort of status that permitted him to travel, and he was literate. And he had traveled in 1795 to what is now called Haiti. At that time, was Santo Domingo, Saint Dominique on the French side. He had been there. He had actually met those who were leading the what became the Haitian Revolution. And he was infatuated with it. That he took the message from it, and he had sailed back and forth in, as a laborer. But he was on the stuff, and he was also an admirer because he was 1795. We're talking about the world was hearing about this phrase: liberty, equality, fraternity. The part that most people liked was the equality stuff. You know, where they say, well, you mean 90% of us are slaves and there's a 10% who own everything. Sounds kind of familiar. And you say that we could all be equal. Yes. Well, I tell you something, 90% of people think that's an interesting idea. And he, José Chirino, brought the word back and was involved with organizing and assisting slaves in a struggle. And he, of course, they did have a slave rebellion in 1795, and unfortunately for José Chirino, but a blessing to all humanity, he was he led that, and it was the beginning of the end of slavery in Venezuela. But this is before Bolivar. This is very important to know. I think everybody should learn his name. And thanks to the President Maduro and the Venezuelan government, I learned about it, and I intend to learn more. But the twin subjects of liberation, ending slavery, and independence were that involved the French Revolution, which wouldn't it, they talk about what people don't know. And French Revolution is not admired in Canada. The names don't come tripping off our tongue because the British didn't like the French Revolution. And fought it for many long years. I don't think they ever succeeded, by the way, but they did their best. But the phrase liberty, equality, fraternity lives on, extremely powerful. And if you had that, and José Chirino did, then you've learned something. Now, by the way, there is a word, and we're going to come back to it in the Taylor Report and future programs, but he is called Zambo. Z-A-M-B-O or Z-A-M-B-O. We have an expression or term which is not used in English because it has a pejorative aspect, Sambo. But in Venezuelan culture, that is attached to his name because it had to do with a mixture of indigenous and black. Now I'm remembering my history taught to me by President Maduro, that it was a his mother, I believe, was Indian, and so or Indio. And anyway, it's very important. I'm glad that we had that music and call attention to this matter in Afro-Venezuelan history. It's going to play a big part in the ongoing struggle today over the over whether or not Venezuela will be permitted to live on as an independent state, or they're going to be continue to be molested, blockaded, and sanctioned by a white power centered European empire, American, Mr. What's his name? Trump, yes, and the others, who intend to dictate to Venezuela what will happen to them. And the backbone of the struggle against a U.S. hegemony will come from Afro-Venezuelans, just as the original revolutionary movements and that of Bolivar, to succeed, had to enlist the support of those who might previously have been considered outside the discussion.